Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and live from Wilmington, North Carolina, one of the spookiest towns on the East Coast. This is Dr. John Stamey, and I want to welcome everybody to the one, the only ScaryCast. We're going to have a lot of fun tonight. We've got a great guest. We've got a great co-host with me, and we're going to have a wonderful time. First of all, I wanted to introduce my co-host, a very good friend, someone who's been with us now for about, Matt, you've been around 7 years. This is one and only Matt Delf. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. Glad to be here.
We are glad you're here, too. And the story that you told me, which I think is kind of interesting, you told me that you had gotten a friend request on Facebook from a fellow that you had seen on a famous TV show. And you told me his name, and I said, yeah, let's try to get him on. And I thought to myself, well, we'll see how that goes. And lo and behold, yesterday morning you said, this guy's going to be on. And that was great. I'd like to introduce to everybody all the ScaryCasters in the world, the one and only Todd Neese from Oregon. How are you doing tonight, Todd?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
We are glad you're here. So here's my first – we got to get into this because you have got a varied, rich, and wonderful history – in paranormal and Bigfoot investigation, you really do. And I don't want to waste a minute because we only have an hour until we get to Clyde Love and Ground Zero at 10 p.m. Eastern. And so we want everyone to be able to enjoy that. So, Todd, tell us, how did you get involved? Tell us a little bit about that story that you sent to me in that incredible resume for everybody to enjoy. And, buddy, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Doc. I kind of got baptized in a unusual way when it comes to Bigfooting. I had a very unusual encounter back in April of 1993. Back then, I was a combat engineer with the Oregon Army National Guard. And for your listening audience, if you're not aware of what combat engineers do, it involves a lot of explosives. And so it was that day, April 3rd to be exact, that we set out into the coast range onto some private timberland and started to go about our training. This particular training scenario included blasts at three different gravel pits, and each type of explosive, each technique was based on the scenario that we were presented with. And anyhow, just to make a long story short, we had detonated the first two sites, moved on to the third and final site, which was to be a cratering charge that involved about 250 pounds of ammonium nitrate that we had been soaking in diesel fuel for several hours prior. And the object was just to blow a huge crater, as the name implies. Generally, we'd use that on a road or something if we wanted to deny the enemy access on any particular road. So we got the explosives in the ground. We put the blasting caps into it. and attach that to that cord and that to some timing fuse and lit it. And as you can imagine, our standard operating procedures get the hell out of there, so we did. There were four vehicles in all, two Humvees up front, a troop transport, and then coming up the rear was the commander's vehicle, which was a Humvee. And so anyhow, I happened to be a passenger in that second Humvee, and as such, I sat behind the driver, and we're heading down toward a safety staging area where we would wait for the explosion and then go back, check our work, you know, get the T-shirt. And it was actually a beautiful day in April, first especially for the Coast Range, which is a temperate rainforest. Nice sunny sky, probably about 3 in the afternoon, I would estimate. And it was a nice enough day. I had the window open, and I was just glancing about the countryside looking for wildlife because I lived in that area, and I hunted that area for both elk and deer. And so it was just natural for me to be looking about to see if I could spot anything. And we come around this corner, so kind of a long sweeping right-hand corner, if you will. And the second blast site, again, a rock quarry, it comes into view. Now, I look down there, and I see these three dark figures standing right out in the open in the middle of this gravel pit, and we had only detonated there only maybe an hour, if not less, prior to these individuals showing up. And my first thought was, what the hell are those people doing down there? Because that was not protocol. It was, everybody had to be accounted for, and there's not going to be one or two or three people, you know, walking about. And I hardly got the thought out of my head when I'm looking closer, and it's like, those are not people. And by that, I mean, for starters, they were huge, much larger than a human. The one in the middle, the tallest one, stood about, I estimated about 9 feet. Two on either side of it, left and right, about 7 to 7.5 feet. They're top of their heads kind of came up to the shoulder of the larger one in the middle. Anyway, the silhouette, it was just, the profile was wrong. The arms were all the way at least to the knees, where our hands normally, you know, reside at our hips. These arms were just way too long, and the legs were too long as well, proportionate to the torso of a human anyway. And then there was the fact that they weren't wearing any clothes. But to top it all off, the one in the middle, it just stood there like a statue. They were facing us, if you can visualize. They're all facing our convoy across the ravine coming down this logging road. The one in the middle stood, you know, rock solid. The two on other side exhibited this rocking back and forth, shifting weight from foot to foot, and in the process, these long pendulous arms swinging at, if not below, their knees. And they did this the entire time I'm witnessing this. And by that, I mean, this wasn't a very brief sighting like many of them. It wasn't, something ran across the road in front of me. I think it was Bigfoot kind of sighting. I watched them for, I estimate, about 25 seconds, but nearly a half a minute. So I got a pretty long view of them. And the entire time, these two either side of the larger one were just doing this Watusi or whatever you want to call it, but they were, you know, just swaying back and forth. So 25 seconds passed. We round the corner. I slumped back in my seat. Just, you know, my brain swimming with 1,001 questions and trying to reconcile what I just witnessed. And it wasn't probably another minute or so that we arrived at that staging area. And I don't know, I just, when we came to a stop, I jumped out. I ran back up the road we'd just come down toward the bomb. But I just wanted to get another look at him if I could. But our policy, our protocol at that time was that everybody was to be within eyesight of the unit. So I went as far as I could. I'm on my tiptoes trying to look over this stupid little hill that's blocking my view when another sergeant comes walking up to me and says, "Hey, niece." I look over and Sergeant Martin, and he's walking toward me. He goes, "What you looking at?" And I go, "Nothing." And he just keeps on coming and gets really, right up to me, and then looks left and right to see if anybody else is within earshot, and they weren't. He said, "I don't suppose you saw what I saw down at that second blast site." And I'm like, "I don't know, Jeff. What did you see?" And he shot back with, "I saw three huge hair-covered, I don't know, Bigfoot, I guess." And of course at that, I went, "Yeah, dude, I did too." And as time went on, there would be two more soldiers to come forward and admitting to witnessing the same thing that I and Sergeant Martin had witnessed. So it's kind of an unusual sighting. Multiple eyewitnesses, multiple animals, that's a pretty rare combination. But then take into account what we were up to up there was blowing up these gravel pits in the middle of the forest. And, these are big explosions. So, sending a mushroom cloud, 200, maybe 2,500 feet up, create a small earthquake for a few seconds. But yeah, that was my epiphany, and I've been researching ever since. 30 years now.
So basically, you saw what you saw, which is about what many of us have seen, some type of anomaly when you've seen a large, tall, hairy dude, and it's like, well, I saw it. There was the realization in your head that you saw it for sure, correct?
I can't unsee it. I mean, I can close my eyes and it's like I'm right back there. It was that vivid, that much of a shock to my memory and my system,
Okay. All right, Matt, do you have a question for Todd?
Yeah, well, his encounter was very similar to mine. I didn't even believe in it, and total skeptic. If it did exist, it was in, out in the mountains somewhere other than where I had my encounter. And I understand whenever you witness something like this, it changes your whole perspective of everything in the world. You're looking at something that's not supposed to exist. You're confused. You're pondering through your head, trying to rationalize what you had seen. But mm-hmm. It sounds like he and his was in 93, mine was in 96. And it takes you down this pathway. And so what were your first, after you had that encounter, how long did it take you to really, of course it made you have questions, then it's kind of like it chose us. We didn't choose it. It chose us because, of course, we got to research it after that. So what was your next steps after having that encounter? What were your next steps and thoughts moving forward?
Well, just to reiterate what you said, it is a life-changing event, something that even though it was relatively brief, it challenges your mind to go beyond that which we're taught in school. And what we hear on TV and everything else is like, holy smokes, not everything there is to be discovered has been discovered. And and lo and behold, you know, somebody needs to rewrite the textbook or something because they're there. But it, I tell you, everything that's happened in the last 30 years has, you know, some connection to that 25-second episode. I wouldn't live where I'm living right now, I guarantee you. What we call the Chateau de Squatch up here in Wildwood. I wouldn't be married to the person I'm married to. Her and I met at a Bigfoot conference in the Wachita Mountains of Arkansas. I wouldn't be...
Beautiful Arkansas, that's great.
Yeah, we got a house back there. We're planning to head back in July. It's nice, especially Western Arkansas. Yeah.
Well,
anyhow, so I mean, all these things that all these people I've met, all these, you know, I put together my own conference or retreat, if you will. I've done that for 16 years. It blows my mind how that one event changed my mind. But to get back to what you were saying, it was kind of funny because I can't remember the last time I was in a library, but at that time I was 34 years old. I made a beeline for the library. I had to get a library card so I can check out an armload of books. I think they limited me at 10, but everything I could find on Bigfoot, because at that time my hunger for knowledge about something I had no knowledge of was a very powerful force, and I wanted to learn the newest, latest, greatest, most, you know, up-to-date scientific information on it. And so I walked out of there with a stack of books, but for me it was a private thing as well. I did not go public about it. Of course, everybody has that fear of having their reputation or even their sanity or honesty challenged. And I would guess myself that 9 out of 10 eyewitnesses to a Bigfoot event don't say a word. So, which is mind-boggling when you consider how many reports we get every year. If you do that times 10, that's like almost every day on the average. So I kind of kept myself, I only shared it with some very, you know, close friends, family members, people that knew I'm not prone to go off and talk about, you know, seeing aliens or the Loch Ness Monster or, you know, some chupacabra or whatever. Told my dad's friend, and this was kind of funny because we all worked together, and we had a guy named Denny that worked there, and I told him the story, and I didn't get that patronizing stare that I got from most people, which I appreciate. He said, you know who you ought to talk to is Melissa, our secretary, because she's down in that area on the coast where you had your sighting. See what she's got to say. So I very sheepishly walked over to her and made sure, again, nobody was within earshot. And I said, Melissa, you grew up on the Oregon coast there, the Coast Range, right? And she goes, yeah, all my life. And I said, again, looking around for anybody hearing, I said, has there ever been any sort of, I don't know, sightings or encounters with Bigfoot? And she, without skipping a beat, she looked at me like I just ate a retard sandwich. She looks at me and she goes, oh, you mean cape apes. Now, this is something I don't generally talk about, I rarely talk about, but that struck me because it was like I was asking her, you guys ever see any cows? And I say that because there's more cows than people in Tillamook, where the, you know, cheese factory is. But it was just the nonchalance of her reply, and she just shot right back like I was like I would just, you know, of course we, yeah, you know. You mean cape apes? I go, what do you call them that? She goes, because, you know, we've got capes out here on the coast every, so, you know, 30, 40 miles, and that's where we see them. So we just, we've called them cape apes ever since I was a kid and probably generations for that. So, I mean, that, so, yeah, that just kind of encouraged me a little bit. Ultimately, I reported this sighting. I was, and I'm sure you can relate, to have what you have, you know, to have the virtual, you know, seeing God moment and then losing it. It's you want to do something about it, you just don't know what to do about it. You don't know where to go and who's going to believe you. You know, what are you going to call the police, the Fish and Wildlife, Forest Service, you know. So bottom line is, there's no way I can prove what I'm saying. It's just that important that it needs to be heard, and I just stumbled across the phone number for the Bigfoot Research Project. This is still in 1993, headed up by Peter Byrne, who I'm sure many of your audience knows. He's currently still with us, the last of the four horsemen of Sasquatchery, and Peter's approaching 98 years old. In fact, I just paid him a visit last week. But his group sent me a questionnaire. I filled it out, sent it back. They sent out a field researcher. He checked things out. What blew my mind was they were able to get the this area, this timber property that we had special permission to use was locked off with heavy gates and ditches on both sides. I mean, I don't think you could get a tank around the thing. And guy says, meet me up at the gate. And I said, well, I can meet you there, but you ain't going to get in. He said, just meet me up there. So I drove up there, met him, and pulls out a key, unlocks the gate, drives his truck, or his Jeep, and I went, who are these people? What sort of clout do they have? And this was the master key to all the gates for the entire area. And anyway, this guy, I directed him to get to where these things were. And there were still craters in the ground from these blocks of C4 that we had put out. They're filled with rainwater. I remember that. But what I distinctly remember is we got up there. I'm with some stranger I don't even know. Kills the Jeep. We're in the quarry. He kills the Jeep. He's walking. And I get out of the Jeep, and all I can hear is the wind blowing through the trees. And I kind of froze. And he looked back, and he says, are you coming? And I said, you know, I'm thinking back. I had 60 troops, fully armed, in this very spot, and they were here. Now I'm here with a stranger, unarmed, and they're here. And I just said, give me a second. And I just had to compose myself a little bit. But we looked around, and we found some interesting potential evidence, and ultimately Peter Byrne himself came out, and we started our friendship back 30 years now. So I didn't go public, though, until 94, when Peter Byrne called me and said, we're doing this show for a company, it's Unsolved Mysteries, would you? I'd like it if you'd join us and be part of the crew. And I'm like thinking, Unsolved Mysteries, Robert Stack, my favorite show. And I said, yeah. But I had to actually, to be honest with you, I struggled with it too, because I was in the National Guard, which means I had a normal job and on the side. And so aside from, you know, here I am, I'm thinking about my reputation. I'm going to go public on something watched by tens of millions of people. You know, I was not just a non-commissioned officer in the Army, but I was family man. I was vice president of a company. And it's like, do you really want to do this? But, you know, when I just put it on a scale and I said, you know what? What I saw was a lot, no pun intended, but what happened to me was bigger than me and my reputation. So I made the decision then and there to talk about it publicly because I think it's important. I think they're important. So how about you? How did you handle it?
I was very
similar. Yeah, man, how did you handle it? And then Dr. John, and I'll go next.
Okay. Yeah, I had actually had my encounter, and, you know, I told a friend of mine, because I told him right after I'd been out there, he asked me what was wrong with me, and I had told him, I was like, what do you mean? He's like, something's wrong with you. And I just kind of stunned, still trying to process in my mind what was going on. And he asked me, he's like, did you see anything? You went hunting, right? And I said, yeah. He said, did you see anything? And I was like, yeah. He's like, what'd you see? I said, I don't know. I mean, in my head, I couldn't. He's like, well, what do you mean you don't know? I said, it was like a monster is what I was trying to, because this was an aggressive encounter, and it got within 30 yards of me, and, I mean, it was screaming and threw a huge stick towards my head, and it messed me up big time, PTSD, fully. And of course, I didn't go public with it. I thought I knew everything in the woods, so I started taking wildlife conservation and college courses. I thought I learned how to track, do everything, but it kind of put a chip on my shoulder because it scared me out of the woods, and I'd never been scared like that or confused at the same time ever before. And so through the years, of course, I'd done my research, I'd investigated stuff, but I kept it on the low, you know, what I did, and it's been the past few, I don't know, 7-8 years that I've really come out public with what I've done, because I told my story to some people at a conference, and you could see the relief from them that they got that, like, hey, okay, we're not crazy. Somebody's here to listen.
Right.
Fear of ridicule.
I've seen that
mockery.
Before.
So, there, you know, I seen the relief from them, and so I started speaking at conferences and stuff like that, and my research is just gone off the charts now. I mean, and I wouldn't be where I'm at either if it wasn't for that one encounter. I wouldn't have met my current girlfriend come through a lot of this stuff, places I've been, all my friends, everything has come from that one encounter. It put the chips into place for everything else that's happened. And it's funny because I'm a operations manager of this medical company, and we'll have, you know, we have conference meetings and conference calls, meetings, all that stuff, and with me being a manager, that one of them had kind of got out, you know, found out that I had done some research, and he tried to ridicule, make a mockery of me in front of everybody. He's like, so you hunt monsters on the weekend, huh? And I looked at him, I said, have you ever seen one? And he said, no. I said, you're welcome. And then I just changed the direction. Everybody just kind of laughed, and he kind of stood there like, wow, you know. But, yeah, it changes your life totally, definitely. And I've done so much research since then. I've started out, but I've got more questions now than when I started.
Yeah, that's the way it is.
Exactly. And
what's up, Doc?
It's 9:30. And by the way, it's 9:30, half past the hour. This is Dr. John Stamey. We want to thank everybody being with us on ScaryCast, sponsored by Transamerica, the world's best life insurance company. If you have a problem or question about your life insurance, please give me a call, 843-655-8775. Again, Transamerica, the best life insurance, 843-655-8775. All right, Todd, we're back to you.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how he dealt with this ridicule factor that I mentioned a lot of us eyewitnesses do. Like I say, the vast majority just, you know, I was at a point before I actually, before I had that corroboration from Sergeant Martin, to I just, like, what are you going to do with this? You know, that's one of the thoughts that goes through your head, and it's like, you know, this is scientifically, historically critical information that you witnessed. You can't just, like, walk away, but most people do. And I remember in 1996 I was asked, and this was actually the first time I spoke in public. Mind you, I had done a few TV shows and documentaries, but 1996 I was asked to speak at what was called the Sasquatch Symposium. And that was held up at Harriet Hot Springs, Harrison Hot Springs in British Columbia on Harrison Lake. And I'm like, okay. You know, I didn't consider myself a researcher at that time at all. I was just, you know, I almost want to say a victim. I was an eyewitness for all intents. And so I was asked to go up there, and they're going to put me up and pay for my travel and whatnot. And that's where I met the likes of all the legendary researchers. I met John Green, Renata Hinden, Professor Grover Krantz, Dr. John Vindernagel, Chris Murphy, Dr. LeBond, John Kirk. I mean, somewhere around here, I still have the programs, and I look back now, I didn't even know who these people were. But I look back now on that program, and I'm like, half these people are dead. All of them were certainly more experienced than myself. But I was asked to go there not so much as a researcher, but as an eyewitness. And a gentleman by the name of Dan Perez, I don't know what he's going by these days, but he was the MC. He puts out the Bigfoot Times, if you've ever subscribed to that. But get out there. Get out there and tell your story. I walk out there. There's like 300 people there. I'm like, you know, hi, my name's Todd. I'm a Bigfootaholic. Hi, Todd. No, it wasn't quite that way. I didn't get a coin or anything. But I'm telling you, it was like, I'm confessing. I'm like standing up in front of a podium with a bunch of people, and they're all looking at me, and I'm supposed to, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I just told them my story. And I got done, and I'm thinking, I'm out of here. And I started walking off stage, and Dan goes, no, you can't leave yet. You got to ask for questions. I'm like, okay. So I go out there. Does anybody have any questions? And the very first person to raise their hands was a guy kind of toward the back. And I went, yes, sir. What's your question? He was a reporter, I would find out. He goes, you just told us this amazing story. Give us one good reason we should believe a word you just said. I'm like, that's not a softball for sure. And I was kind of stunned for a second, and I got a little bit mad. And after maybe a 5-second pause, I said, I was asked here to tell you what I lived through. Whether or not you believe it or not doesn't change the truth.
Exactly.
And that guy sunk down in his chair, and I remember that vividly because it was like, where did that come from? But I mean, It is.
And,
I mean,
and Todd, this is Dr. John. You made a horrible mistake. You didn't pursue that line of comment with him. I mean, you let him go with a softball. You should have said, then what makes you believe that I didn't see what I saw? You should have hammered on him. And I'm
no,
and
what
I mean
should
that,
have said.
You're mistaken.
What
in a
I should have
way.
Said is, what I should have said is, okay, you show me proof that they don't exist, because absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence.
Yep.
Then see what he says. We're discovering things almost daily, or easily daily, I would say, in terms of new species. You know, life goes on, and things evolve, and things unfortunately go into extinction, and it's just a cycle. Survival of the fittest. Which is one reason that I founded my conservancy, the American Primate Conservancy, back in 2015. And, you know, experiencing, I'm sure Mac can relate what I did, you know, it messes with you. And for me, there was this proverbial question, why me? Right?
Exactly.
Why me?
Yep.
And you just can't let it go at that. You got to find an answer for that. And for me, because like Matt said, you don't find them, they find you. The reason you saw them is because they wanted you to see them. For every deer you see, 1,000 have seen you. You just never saw them. The bottom line is, what do I do? It's what this gift, I do consider it a gift in the long run, what this gift I've been given, you know. And the answer for me was this conservancy, which is based on science and education. Our mission statement is the discovery, research, knowledge, recognition, and protection of this species. We've discovered them. They're discovered more often than most people would even believe. We've been doing the research, and as technology goes forward, you know, we get some new toys that maybe were out of our price range that have, you know, thermal cameras and night vision and stuff I didn't even think about back when in 93. But, I mean, so the knowledge base, the database, the research is more intense. The database is growing. But the fourth leg of that mission statement is recognition. And what's important about that is the fifth leg, the final leg, is protection. Will not happen without the fourth leg, just like the third leg won't happen without the second leg, and so on. So it's a progressive struggle, what we're trying to do. But, and a lot of people say, leave them alone. They're doing fine. Well, that's just a romantic notion. If you don't know how many there are today, how many there were 100 years ago, 1,000 years, 10,000 years ago, or how many there's going to be in 100 years from now. That's just stupid to suggest that they don't need our help. And, okay, I'll bite. Let's say they don't need our help. Fine. Let's find out. But until we do, it is irresponsible for us not to make the assumption that they may or may not need our help. It's just, you know, base it on scientific fact. Let's get this thing you know, I don't know what I'm going to do when, and I believe it's inevitable, I don't know what I'm going to do when these things are, this species is finally recognized. But I'm sure I'll find something else.
Hopefully,
maybe
shipwrecks. This is what you'll do is you'll find that it's recognized, and then you'll just move forth to another one. That, absolutely. And by the way, we're glad to have Kyler Smith with us tonight. Kyler, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm kind of sad that I missed the story because it sounds awesome, but I'll have to go back and listen.
That's exactly right. Well, we're glad you're here. We'll let you listen a little bit, then we'll have you in the next round of questions. So, Todd, what are you doing essentially today in your research that you're learning more about the Bigfoot phenomenon? It's Dr. John Stamey, and that's my question.
Okay, well, you're not throwing any softballs. No. I have, you know, you can imagine over 30 years with the evolution of technology, my own studies and really networking with hundreds of constituents in the same, you know, colleagues, if you will. I've evolved right along with it. So, you know, like Matt says, every time you answer a question, you get, you know, hit with about three or four more. So how do you handle that? What do? We, you know, we employ the technologies that we can. They've been marginally successful. And I think what we need to do is just think. I think it comes down to intelligence. And I think it comes down to the appreciation of their intelligence, for one. I mean, you got to get outside the box a little bit here. I mean, we're not like darting zebras off the front of a Jeep in the, you know. No, this is leading edge, you know, front row seat sort of research. And so I'll give you a couple examples. Intelligence-wise, for instance, everybody asks me, are they intelligent? How intelligent are they? I was like, how intelligent are you? They ask me. I mean, but the truth is, I started thinking about it. I'm like, okay, how do we measure intelligence? Well, intelligence is measured in what we call the IQ, intelligence quotient. Now, I'm pretty sure the IQ, the intelligence quotient today, I'm sure they've adjusted the scale to where it was, say, 100 years ago, or maybe 150 years ago, you know. But what is intelligence? It's not just the assimilation of knowledge. It's the application. It's the what you do with it. Okay, so what are we talking about? What do you do with what? Data. Okay. What's data? Well, data is like technology driven. Data is just knowledge. Data. So when we look at knowledge and we look at where we're at today versus, say, 500 years ago, okay, our knowledge base was a lot less than that. You know, or was it? Because I believe there's, In an evolutionary scale, there are at least two categories. And I believe they're pretty much parallel. However, they're very distinctly different. One is academic intelligent quotient, or what I call AIQ, versus primal intelligence quotient. So hang with me. Let's talk about Neanderthal or Cro-Magnon or whatever before that in the hominid species versus today. We had back then was certainly a a whole different category of intelligence. It was more primal, correct? So
correct.
Primal in terms of day-to-day survival, being able to forage, shelter, being able to hunt, you know, all the above. And so here we are, us humans, Western society, whatever you want to call it, we don't need that, because what we've done, and by that I'm talking about going over probably close to 100,000 years, is we have sacrificed, or we have surrendered that PIQ for convenience, born out of technology. We don't need to worry about shelter. We'll go buy a house. We don't need to worry about food. It's in our freezer and refrigerator. We don't need to worry about heat or cold. We don't need all this. Okay. But hear me out. Let's say if China one day decides to detonate an EMP device over this country, everything electronic is gone, both AC and DC. Humankind would suffer immensely, if not go extinct, at least we're in that region, because we can't refrigerate our food, we can't cook our food, we can't be warm, we don't, they can't even pump gas. Whatever gas you got in your tank, that's it, except, oh yeah, your car battery doesn't work anymore. How do you think that affects Bigfoot? Oh, that's right. Just another day. So now who's the smart one? Who's the most intelligent?
And I just wanted to make a comment. What people see and what they don't see, but yet what they report is just amazing. I mean, people will say, I've never seen Bigfoot, and you know they have. Or they can say, I've seen Bigfoot all the time, and they've never seen it. What do you think is the trigger to get people to tell the truth? Is that an okay question?
Well, I don't know if there's so much a trigger. I think there's intuition. Just from personal experience, I think there's a tremendous advantage for researchers who are also experiencers or knowers or whatever you want to call yourself, in that there are people that want Bigfoot exists. There are people that believe Bigfoot exists. There are people that wish Bigfoot exists. And then there's people that know. And again, it's a tremendous advantage on several, you know, levels. One, just in research. Because one of the first things that struck me, especially being an avid hunter, hiker, fisherman, whatever, it's like, and then discovering something like this is out there, it made me go, how many times did I walk right past very good evidence, dismissed it out of hand, didn't even consider it because it didn't make sense. You know, now I go out with the knowledge that they exist, and now I can see all kinds of stuff I didn't see before. So conversely, people who've had a sighting, if they were to talk to somebody who has not had a sighting, they're going to tell you this story, right? Now, put that same person in front of somebody that they can relate to, and it's a whole different thing. And I usually, when somebody says, hey, you need to talk to this person, they've had an encounter, they've had an experience, you need to talk to them, first thing I do is go, hey, you know what, nice to meet you, before you even go, say a word, I'm just going to tell you, been there, seen that. Now, you know, and I'll give them some details. But the expression on their face, the emotion that you can literally feel. Their eyes get bigger, their shoulders drop, and you can't shut them up. And they go into such detail that they never would with somebody who they're talking to that they believe don't believe them in the first place. As a experiencer, if that's the right word, when they can relate to you as to having, and I keep going back to this when I talk about, you know, trauma or victim or whatever, it is trauma. It's a traumatic experience to see something that is that powerful, that is, you know, that literally takes you to a different level of consciousness, literally. You become conscious of things that you never saw before. And I'm not going to close the door on anything other than Bigfoot, because kind of got my ass handed to me that day, you know? So, no, my judgment is what I have left to use, but I can tell you after interviewing hundreds of people over 30 years that I honestly can tell you that my intuition, watching their expressions, the body language, and everything else that goes along with it, I know if somebody's blowing smoke, telling the truth. Short of that, you know, I don't know. I just got to go with that. But I'll tell you what, I think that's the best gauge, the best bellwether as to whether somebody's being honest with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That is certainly very interesting. And so what types of research programs are you going to be embarking on from this point forward so that we can kind of like know what you're going to be doing? Because we'd love to follow what you're doing.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, this in the past year and a half, I'm working on different research, different theories. I talked about earlier today, and I was saying, you know, we gotta think outside the box, because even as technologies, you know, increasing and becoming more cost effective, everybody's grabbing up the stuff and going out there and pretty much coming back with the same results. So I'm like, how do I go around this? You know, there was a specific event that really impacted me. And I've talked to Matt about it earlier, but you know, who kind of alluded to the whole paranormal, supernatural, woo, whatever you want to call it, things. And I said, you know, there was an incident less than 2 years ago where I was invited to the Omaha Indian Reservation in Nebraska, which is on the far east end, literally the eastern border of Nebraska with Iowa. The Missouri River divides them. And I was, first of all, if anybody asked me what's like the top three states in the continental United States that you would say Bigfoot doesn't exist, I think I'd put Nebraska right up there. You know, I'm like, I'm seeing cornfields forever.
Todd, I'm going to have to disagree with you, because our friend Harriet McFeely runs the Nebraska Bigfoot Conference, and there are hundreds of sightings of Bigfoot out there, believe it or not.
You're saying on the west side?
In Nebraska.
Yeah.
And there are hundreds of sightings of Bigfoot, and there are lots of, and this is one thing that we try to do, is to share information, because she's got a book about Bigfoot experiences. So you know, I'll just say this, and this is my belief, is that there are thousands of Bigfoot everywhere. All you have to do is drive past some forests, and there's Bigfoot there. And I think they're evenly distributed. Now, I'm just saying that from experiences that I've had, and I didn't mean to correct you, but I'm just saying Nebraska turns out to have a lot of Bigfoot experiences. So I'll be glad to share those with you because I think it's important that we share and learn here.
Well, had you let me continue, I would have told you that I've pretty much had my butt handed to me when I went to Nebraska and I experienced Bigfoot, not just once, but five times. And that's what I experienced out there was mind-blowing. So I was merely saying that originally, had you asked me where they'd be, I would not have thought of Nebraska. But again, I was corrected and was treated to five nights, simultaneous nights in two different locations where I can say with 99% assurance. I don't know why I can't say 100, but I'll tell you what I experienced in five different nights, Monday through Friday, on the reservation was something that I had put in the category of supernatural or paranormal. And because when somebody says to me, these creatures have a certain sort of capability, my first go-to is, okay, show me one other animal in the animal kingdom that has that capability, and then we can talk. And that particular thing is what a lot of people allude to as eye shine.
Right.
And again, I had written it off. But 5 nights in a row from like midnight to 2 o'clock in the morning, sometimes 3, we were visited by not one, but as many as 3 sets of eyes that were blinking that seemed to be generating their own light. But I have a theory on that as well. We can discuss later. But again, we went to 2 different locations in 5 nights, and we had activity in both locations. And this particular individual who was a tribal member had established this relationship with this particular group over a 3-year period. So it seemed obvious to me that they knew him and he knew them because he could call out to them in his native tongue and literally bring them in. And something in my eyes and say, hey, really happens. It happens. Again, I can't unsee it. But what I can do is try to explain it. And I have set out coming up with theories with regards to that. Again, we can talk at another time. But what it ultimately did is open my mind a little bit to, hey, you know, I've got a lot of friends that are strictly scientific, biologic, you know, minded people like myself. But I got a whole bunch, too, that kind of go off in this more fringe, if you will, sort of mindset. And if it is like 1 or 2 people, I'd go, yeah, you know, it's counseling, whatever. But, it, you know, when you hear it from 20, 40, 60, 100 people, there's always a bit of truth in everything, right? So because of what I experience out there in Nebraska, I've kind of made it my, I guess let's say I mellowed my stance on paranormal, not so much to walk away from the scientific biological, but to kind of stand on that third rail between the two and say, hey, how can I bridge this gap between the woo, I know people don't like that, paranormal, how can I make paranormal normal? How can I make supernatural natural? Is there a way to bridge this? Because there a way to find a scientific explanation for what people are legitimately seeing? I don't have a problem with them saying they saw what they saw. I just take exception with your particular explanation. So that's kind of what I've been doing lately. Aside from that, I've been working on an initiative with indigenous people to try to get some protections put into, through their natural resources departments to get protections, at least as it pertains to reservations, because they have, they're basically nations within our nation, and they have their own autonomy and their own laws, and I think it's an easier sell with people that have been hanging out with them for, 21,000 years versus our 300. And I think that will help brief the slides ultimately to go to the Department of the Interior, who's in charge of Fish and Wildlife and the Forest Service, and just say, hey, you're kind of surrounded by all these reservations that have signed off on this. So I put together a draft proposal that I've been working with several tribes with. They can each tweak it the way they want, but make it very legal, where they attach some sort of monetary or jail time to anybody that would intentionally harass, harm, or kill one of these things, just for whatever reason. But so that's one of the things we're working on with the Conservancy. I don't know how much time we got left, but I am working on an experiment with fiber optics with regards to people saying that they seem to appear and disappear randomly and that they're transdimensional or go through a portal or what have you. I played that card I spoke about earlier about finding some historical reference in known animals to that I could apply to that circumstance, and I came up with the all things the polar bear. And I've been trying to spread this in the gospel of Todd that polar bears aren't white. Polar bears are not white. They have a tannish fur, and they have these outer guard hairs, which are translucent, hairs that extend beyond the base fur. And not only they're used for absorbing light and color, which whatever's around them, you can imagine fiber optics just transfers light, but it also transfers heat, I found out. And so it would pull in heat, work kind of as a heat exchanger just through the hair. But I would encourage anybody to look it up. What color is a polar bear? Just Google it, whatever. They are not white. They don't have any white hair on them, per se. So why not Bigfoot? Why not Bigfoot? Now I got an example in nature. Is there a way to replicate that? So what I've done is about 1,000 feet of probably half a millimeter fiber cable. And I wanted to do this on a level of scale of a bear skin, but right now I've been given a beaver pelt, fairly sizable beaver pelt. So I'm going to work this experiment on, a micro scale. But I'm going to take pictures of this pelt in specific locations in the woods under specific light conditions before and after. And what I mean by after is I'm going to go back, take it back to my house, and I'm going to start infusing these clear fiber optic cable, if you will. I call it cable. It's like fishing line, pretty much. But I'm going to start inserting that through the back into the front of the hide and a little bit beyond that of the base coat. Photograph it again, same location, same lighting, and see if that little beaver pelt doesn't just disappear. By absorbing the light, ambient light, and color of its surroundings. If that's the case, there's your bridge.
Wow.
Makes sense?
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right, and listen, that's wonderful. Now, I tell you what, we're out of time because we're butting up against Clyde Lewis and Ground Zero. But I tell you what, Todd, we really appreciate you talking. We'd love to have you back. You got some interesting perspectives, and we'll talk with you offline, as you said, and with Matt and with Kyler, and we'd love to have you back. So, first of all, would you come
I'd
back
be
in
honored.
A couple of weeks? Well, thank
I'd be
you.
Honored
we'd
too.
Love to have you. Number one,
it's been
we'd
fun.
Love to have you. And wanted to thank you for being here on ScaryCast, our Tuesday edition. And Matt Delph, thank you for bringing him to us. And Kyler, we're glad you were here. And we'll talk offline, and we'll have some more questions for you. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
All right, good. Well, all right. Well, Kyler, thanks a lot. Matt, thanks a lot. And we'll see everybody next week, same bat time, same bat channel. On ScaryCast, now, here's what we always like to do. We want to ask everybody to say hello.